Great Lives is a download from Radio 4. We hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. Astonish me, said the choreographer Diaghilev to the subject of this week's Great Lives. And arguably, Our Great Life made a career out of doing just that. He was an artist, a writer, a filmmaker, impresario, a playwright and a poet. He's been described as a prototype reality TV star with a flair for self-publicity, as frivolous, as a dandy, and as a man of formidable cleverness. And one of his many friends summed him up with, he was adorable, except for the times when you wanted to strangle him. Our subject is Jean Cocteau, and he's proposed by this week's guest, the writer Francesca Simon, creator of, amongst other books, the wildly popular Horrid Henry series for children. She describes herself as a giddy fan. Why giddy, Francesca?
Basically, I think just because I love him so much. And the more I get to know him or know about him, the more I like him. And I'm just wildly enthusiastic about him, about his life, about what he looks like, about his films, his artwork. I think that's fairly giddy.
Are you even capable of disapproval of him?
I'm very capable of disapproving of people who don't like him.
How did you first encounter his work?
Well, I first encountered him, actually, on the day he died, which was because I was a child in Paris. And because he died on the same day as Edith Piaf in 1963, I just remember...
His friend.
His friend, this great cultural figure, had died. But I first encountered him when I was properly as a teenager, because I grew up in L.A., and there was this one little cinema that used to, at midnight, show kind of French films. And because I'm passionate about Greek mythology, so I saw this film called Orphée, and I was really intrigued that someone had made a film about Orphée, and I went to see it, and I was knocked out by it.
But it must have been more than the fact that you shared an interest in the subject. Something about his filmmaking must have clicked with you.
I think what really clicked was his interest in magic, and that he saw lots of magical things in the everyday. I loved his interest in mirrors, because I've always been quite intrigued by mirrors, and in fact I wrote a senior thesis at Yale about mirrors and fountains.
What was his interest in mirrors?
Well, he described them as the doors through which death comes and goes. And in the film Orphée, Death, who's this rather austere princess, kind of comes through the mirror. In the film, Orphée gets these strange messages over his car radio. You know, things like, l'oiseau chante avec ses doigts. The bird sings with its fingers. And just this sort of strange, odd way of looking at the world. It made me look at the world differently. One of the things about Cocteau that I find really interesting is that he was so good at so many things. So I first discover him as, you know, this icon who's died. Don't think about him again. Just then find him as a filmmaker. Then I take French classes at university, discover that he's also a playwright and a novelist. Then I start seeing his artwork. And I'm always surprised. Now I know more about his life as well. I mean, I go on holiday to Villefranche, which is a place I love, and then I discover that he lived in Villefranche for years and years, and he was crazy about it.
Were you, at that time when you were studying in France, were you a budding writer then? What were you doing?
I've always been interested in writing. I mean, I can't say. I mean, to me, that would be slightly presumptuous. I encountered Cocteau, and that turned me into a writer. But I think we share lots of things. I think we're both quite impish, and we're both quite playful. And I think the thing probably I admire the most about him is the way he had a very particular way of looking at the world. And he just very unapologetically went for it.
You became... not only, but not least, a children's writer. Did you start as a children's writer?
I've always been a children's writer, and I've never had any interest in writing for adults. I was a journalist, and I started writing for children almost the moment my son was born. And I just discovered that the kind of skills that I had were perfect for writing for children.
Is Cocteau accessible to the child's imagination? Do you think?
Completely, because he's so magical. I mean, a film like La Belle et la Bête, where Belle walks into this enchanted castle and all the statues start moving. And there are these, just these arms that are thrust through the wall, carrying, holding torches. And the torches all start to move, following Belle as she walks down. Oh, completely. I think he's incredible for children.
Let's talk first a little bit about his work. We talk about his life as well. The writer and critic, Raymond Mortimer, terms his imagination quite personal and his own. What does Mortimer mean by a personal imagination?
I think that possibly he means that Cocteau, in a sense, creates his own mythology.
Mm.
So he'll have his own images that keep coming up. I mean, I do think a good example is Urtebise, the angel, who appears in Orphée as the assistant of Death. And Urtebise is described really oddly as a vitrier, which is a window pane seller. And I was always puzzled by this. It seems such a very particular and such an odd thing to say. And I was walking in Paris in the late 70s, and I heard this call, you know, vitrier! And there was this man walking down the street with these window panes that were straight up his back. But because the sun was hitting the panes, he was walking in this orb of light. It was extraordinary. I mean, I really felt like kind of Cocteau had just grabbed me by the arm, because I've never before or since seen a vitrier. But that's what I mean, that he would look at something so kind of prosaic as a window pane seller and have him be
everything
an angel.
Everything he touches sort of springs to.
Everything he touches becomes very magical. Mm. And I love that about him.
We're lucky to have with us, too, Dr. Andy Martin, lecturer at the Faculty of Modern and Medieval Languages at Cambridge. Andy, I'd like to talk a little bit about Cocteau's childhood, where he came from. It's here that the first suicide, and suicide becomes a recurring theme in his life, happens. Just take us through a little of that.
Well, it's easy to remember when he's born. It's 100 years after the French Revolution, so it's 1889. The suicide of his father, I think he was age 9 or 10, it seemed to be very pervasive in his work, the theme of suicide. I mean, I think there's hardly a film of his or a book in which one or more than one, the mass suicide, in fact, could be described as the leitmotif of his
work.
Do we
know why he killed himself?
There was some suggestion that his father was homosexual, and that may have been a contributing factor, but no one knows. This is just speculation. Mm.
Can I just say, with regard to Francesca's love for Cocteau, it's not something I share myself, and I suspect my brief here may be to not be a lover of Cocteau. I'm not sure I'd recommend him as a role model to my kids exactly. For starters, he was a drug addict.
He was certainly a drug addict.
Even more ironically, he was a rehab addict as well.
I think 7 times, paid for by Coco Chanel, which is, I think, typically glamorous if you're going to go into rehab to have Coco Chanel pay for you. Yeah, but I think you can admire someone without wanting to live their life. He's larger than life. So I think I kind of extend a kind of creative license to him. I wouldn't necessarily want to be married to him or for him to be my parent or my child, but I certainly enjoy it.
Nor presumably would he want to be married to you, one imagines.
You
could have turned him. But I just want to get a sense of the Paris in which, as a young man and as a young artist and poet, he was finding his feet. It was an extraordinary world, wasn't it?
Mm. And he just knew everyone and worked with everyone. And
Picasso, Satie.
Stravinsky.
He was involved with the ballet, with
Diaghilev.
I think just his acquaintance and just his ability to kind of move everywhere. I think it's hard not to be kind of in awe of him, I think.
I'd like to get a picture of what he looked like as a young man. In fact, we've brought a few into the studio.
Devastating.
He was painted and photographed by some of the greatest artists of the time, Modigliani, Picasso, Dufy, Man Ray.
You mentioned the role of mirrors.
Mm. Here he is, looking through a mirror as it's an incredibly good-looking young man, don't you think? He almost looks like one of his own drawings, like a cartoon. As though he says has been sketched into the world rather than plonked onto the world.
He's got this great handwriting, this kind of very quick, flowing, wonderful handwriting.
The drawing is it's like calligraphy in a sense, isn't it? My notion of him is now he would have made a great graphic novelist, actually. supplying the words and the graphics simultaneously. I think he would have been really
good at that. Graphic novels. I think he was so interested in the possibilities of different art forms.
They called him the frivolous prince. Is frivolous a fair?
I think that's unfair. I think sometimes when people are really good at lots of things, there's this tendency to look down on them. They can't be serious. They can't, if they're too good at too many things.
I think it was also partly because he was very elegant. He tends to describe gloves rather carefully, for example, in his writing. And I suspect that that was true of himself too, actually. And certainly when you see him in his films, he's always perfectly turned out. The tie is always very carefully tied, for example. And he's the only painter I know who wears a suit all the time to do his painting. Certainly when he shows himself as a painter. So he has this air of the dandy. I think he said it was like death to be taken too seriously. So perhaps he wouldn't have himself objected to the notion of being frivolous. But certainly I think when you look slightly beyond the mask, you find, you know, much more of the kind of dark ironist, slightly tormented, slightly conflicted.
I don't see him as frivolous at all. I see him, given that he was an opium addict for 20 years, I find it absolutely astounding how much, you know, and how much time he obviously spent getting dressed, that he produced so much artwork. I mean, just the tons and tons of artwork that he was able to produce. In fact, he actually isn't frivolous. He's playful. And I think that's a much better word, I think, to describe him than frivolous. And he played with things and ideas and images and people.
He described himself in these terms: I am the lie that tells the truth.
One can't help but feel there's a kind of, you know, gay code there to some extent, that he's being somewhat deceptive all the time. Although, one should say this, that I think he's actually the most explicit of all the gay writers of that period.
I was going to say, when so many of the obituaries say his sexuality was elusive. It didn't seem very elusive to me.
He was totally open and out. I mean, he and Marais were completely out as a couple.
He was very into young boys.
No, that's unfair.
He adopted some of his lovers.
He did, but Delmitte was 22 then, so they were certainly of age.
Shall I tell you why I said that? Because I was reading recently, because we all know about this love affair that he had with Raymond Radiguet, the wonderful Raymond Radiguet, who died young at the age of 20, partly as a result of going off on a trip with Cocteau himself, contracted typhoid, but wrote a couple of brilliant novels very early. But this is the thing that struck me. Okay, he, Cocteau, adopted Radiguet, but the reality is he actually had a real father. His father had not committed suicide. And the thing that was on my mind is, I'm reading the letters, the anguish letters, from the real father to the symbolic father, saying, where's my son? What have you done with him exactly?
Well, I think that Cocteau always attracted massive numbers of young men, and they were obviously drawn to him not for his beauty, because his beauty did fade fairly quickly, and certainly with Radiguet, I mean, that's another story, because of course this boy kind of comes and wants to be part of Paris, and Cocteau sets him up in an apartment, but I mean, he was essentially straight, so I'm not sure how much fun he had with Radiguet other than being tormented by him. But I mean, if I'd been Radiguet's father, I would have been upset too.
Was he good? Was he kind? Did he want to do good things in the world? Or was he completely careless of that side of life?
He was very, very devoted to his friends and would clearly just do anything for anyone that he cared about. And it also sounds like he was also quite generous to people who were horrible to him.
He was more the brave, wasn't he? If you think of what he got up to in the First World War, actually, where his ill health disqualified him from actually joining up. But he did this Hemingway-style thing, didn't he, of going off to the front and becoming an ambulance man.
You're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, Francesca Simon, has chosen Jean Cocteau, and our expert witness is Dr. Andy Martin. You've both briefly mentioned opium addiction. The opium addiction was really serious, wasn't it, all his life?
It was all his life, and he obviously never completely got away from the opium.
And then, of course, when he was emerging from the addiction, when he'd gone through, I think, his first rehab, that was when he was supposed to have written Les Enfants Terribles, in fact.
What, in sort of 7 days or something?
Or
insane.
17, some very short, so he claimed, who knows.
Yes. But 20 days.
Yeah,
let's be generous.
It looks like a rapidly written novel, to be fair, actually. Probably where the literature is concerned, I think it's the single production of his that probably endures, that, for example, that most students will probably pick up at some stage and read. And it's a very dark book. It's supposed, of course, to be about a couple of kids who have an incestuous relationship. I've always been a bit dubious about that, because you look at it and there's absolutely no incest there whatsoever. I'm sorry to disappoint anyone, unless there's a line in it which I may have skipped.
And also
but
in the film
they do
well.
Torment one another. That's the key thing.
It's much more that they're like this hermetic kind of brother and sister who don't seem to have any parents around, so they go a bit feral.
Yeah.
But no, I agree with you. There's no... It just feels like they're kind of involved in dark things.
Well, to give an example, it ends, as I recall, because as you say, Andy, they have a game of tormenting each other and being trying to do everything they can to hurt the other. And at the end, I think the boy, the young man, is committing suicide and dying, thinking that he's got the last laugh because he's really tormented his sister now, and she quickly kills herself first so that he loses even that battle.
I think he shoots himself anyway, doesn't he, having lost the game, but feeling rather depressed that she has got in ahead of him.
You see, it's one of the things I really do like about Cocteau, that he always takes things right to the edge.
Yes.
You know, it's something I find as a writer inspiring about being bold. And he really championed writers and he was kind of so excited about other people's work. So he wasn't kind of crabbed in any way, I don't think, about other writers or other artists.
No, not at all. That's true. He was quite happy to go around stealing stuff, wasn't he, actually?
And, I think the word you're seeking is homage.
Oh, yeah, homage. he had all those collaborations.
You don't really like him, do you, Andy?
I'm not sure I would care to hang out with him for an evening.
I would love to.
But I find him fascinating, nevertheless. I mean, I can't help but know, even someone like Stravinsky complained about him. Yes, you mentioned the homage thing, but you can overdo it as a fan. You know, Stravinsky says, my God, I wish he'd leave me alone occasionally. He's such a sort of wheedling devil. He's always on at me and, you know, he loves me and everything, but God, give me some space. And I think...
I wouldn't ask for space.
You wouldn't? Okay, great.
Now I'm going to challenge you here, Francesco. You've said that you will neither hear nor speak ill of this man, but...
And he was great.
But objective about the Second World War. He didn't have a very good war, did he?
I think he would describe it as that he was trying to join up with other artists and that he probably felt in some way that he wanted to be above what was happening.
But his friends were taking stands against Hitler, many of them, and he wouldn't. He didn't.
He probably should have, you know. But I always think it's very difficult, you know, from where we are to judge what it was like for other people. He was also, you know, he was openly gay, so he might have also felt quite vulnerable in terms of his own security. Mm. And I think that also changes how people are. He certainly wasn't handing over his Jewish friends, far from that.
But his lover, Jean Marais, at that time was working for the resistance, and still he distanced himself from
all that. There was an interesting comment in the book I read by James Williams, that the idea that they didn't trust Cocteau not to talk. That they worried that the resistance were concerned about having him on board.
He was a terrible gossip.
He'd
be name-dropping and suddenly they'd all be executed.
Well, that there could be problems there.
I'm quite sympathetic to him. I'm sure Francesca is right that the gay factor must have been huge because we know that the Nazis were very anti-gay. And certainly, I think it was just before, maybe just during the occupation, there's this great and terrible writer, Robert Brasillach, who was one of those sort of fascist writers, and he was denouncing Cocteau's work. I think he was using words like putrefaction and defilement. That denunciation seems to me now, in retrospect, to be very much an affirmation of Cocteau as this individual figure. And I think now, with hindsight, he's a sort of post-ideological figure, isn't he? In which he said, well, look, I'm not really in the right, I'm not in the left, I don't belong to a party.
He's elsewhere.
In effect, yeah. In a sense, the Second World War, it was a bad time not to be aligned in that way. But he's a non-aligned kind of a guy, isn't he? Trying to do his own thing always
and trying
to transcend.
I mean, he was certainly attacked by people like Brasillach for loving Jews. I think he was probably keeping a low profile.
La Belle et la Bête was made during the Second World War, just after.
Yeah.
And you're completely obsessed by this film, Francesca.
Yeah, I love it.
Why?
I watch it a lot because I never quite get a handle on it. There are a lot of exchanges in it where La Belle, you know, is in the castle with Babette, and he goes, you know, La Belle. She goes, oui, La Bête. And then he goes, La Bête. Oui, La Belle. Which I always found very funny. And again, it's those touches that always amuse me. The special effects are unforgettable. They're so simple in a way, and they're so magical. And just the way he creates this enchanted place. But also, I always get the feeling that there is something very tragic about Cocteau. I mean, to me, it's very clear that, you know, he identifies with La Bête. I mean, his curse, you could say, is that he kept falling in love with men of such sort of transcendental beauty and who are always much younger than him. So that is a curse in itself, because he was always going to feel hideous next to them, and he was never going to be able to hold them.
He's completely and immediately identified to me by the art, by the little sketches, by the single line. You're wearing a brooch, just one line of Cocteau's. It's beautiful. It's distinctive. It's completely sui generis. I don't know that there are any other artists who ever did this.
For me, his artwork is my favourite thing of all. And I've kind of made kind of journeys all over the place to see it. I mean, I love his Greek figures. I think his artwork is beautiful, and his pottery is beautiful. I love what you said about Cocteau. You know, if he was working today, would be probably interested in being a graphic artist and do graphic work. I'm sure that that's right. I always feel that Cocteau does leave actually a kind of big enigmatic space for you to fill in. I mean, he almost presents his own mythology and his own way of looking at the world, and then invites you in. He is cryptic. He is interesting.
He received many plaudits all the way through his life, including an honorary degree from Oxford. And he came to England to receive this in 1956 and recorded an interview for the BBC, which shows how very limited his English was.
I speak English when I am alone in my room. But when I am here, all is finished. I cannot speak. I am like a child. I speak English like a Spanish cow.
Oxford, you know it quite well, I think.
Yes, when I was young, I come in Oxford, and it was like a dream for me. It is a dream, a real dream. Je suis reçu comme docteur, et I don't speak Latin. I don't speak English, speak bad French.
You're an honorary doctor of Oxford University, là.
J'estime que, en moi, en ma personne, le collège honore l'intensité d'une vie, de toute une vie. Et je vous répète encore que c'est un immense honneur pour moi. Et je ne peux... Voilà, I speak very well with my heart.
The photographer Cecil Beaton, who knew Cocteau well, was scathing about his publicity seeking. Some people take to drink, some people take to sex, some people take to drugs. He took to publicity. And I think that considering he was such a remarkable man of such worth, it was very unfortunate that he should like to see his photograph in Paris Match every week, that he should go to the Cannes Festival and be photographed with starlets. I must say I disagree with Cecil. The show was part of the man, wasn't it?
I think the show was part of the man. And I also think one of the things that I find very touching about the interview that you just played, the one that he did when he came for his honorary doctorate, was how totally thrilled he is to get this honor. And he doesn't pretend that he's above it, or he's not pompous about it. He just completely embraces it. And I love what he said about that he feels that the honor is for his life, which is, of course, what interests me. It's like for the totality of his work. I agree with you. I completely disagree with Cecil Beaton, because he is kind of glamorous.
Yeah.
He is painting in his suit. He is a work of art himself. Yes. If all he did was go to Cannes and hang out with starlets, then yes, Cecil Beaton would have a point. But that's a tiny interlude in between him throwing pots and drawing and making films and writing scripts.
Come on, Andy, pour cold water on our enthusiasm here.
No, I was quite touched, to be honest, listening to that interview, because he obviously has the capacity for love and excitement. I think that comes out there. He's also surprisingly modest. I think the fact is that he's somehow kind of sunk down into our cultural archaeology. I mean, in some sense, we all agree with Cocteau now, don't we, that you have to construct yourself. You know, there is no fixed identity that you're born with, that you have to live with and you're stuck with.
There is a problem if you have had a great life, or it's been a marvellous show anyway, which his life was, that when those who remember you, or those who knew people who remember you, go, the life fades. That can't be entirely recorded, except in anecdote. And I wonder whether there may prove to have been something a little insubstantial about Cocteau as an artist and a writer.
I think that's one's first feeling, and he feels himself to be insubstantial. I mean, there are a lot of kind of ghosts and so on in his work. But I think the fact is that there's some enduring works of his. I think the sorts of films that Francesca's referred to, certainly Beauty and the Beast, Orfei, and certainly I think the influence of Cocteau is felt very widely, except perhaps invisibly, even in something, say, like Lucasfilms and special effects, maybe even something like Star Wars, or even in Disney, you may say, who basically stolen his film to all intents and purposes.
I'm smiling to myself here because usually in our great lives, or so often, we have an expert witness who's a little sceptical, pours a little cold water, and eventually succeeds in disillusioning our enthusiastic nominator. But in this case, you appear, Francesca, to have won the expert witness round, who's now stoutly defending the great life of Jean Cocteau, who died, as you say, of a heart attack just after his great friend Edith Piaf had died. The writer François Mauriac marvelled that Cocteau, quote, could do something as natural, as simple, as undevised as dying. A great epitaph. To the last question, and it's a question posed in the programme for the National Film Theatre's tribute season to Cocteau in 2004. Has he survived his life? Or does he impinge on our current consciousness as a dandified dilettante admired by his own period, but of utter irrelevance to ours? I'll give you the last word, Francesca, in answering that. Utter irrelevance, dandified dilettante.
I think, if anything, Cocteau is going to gain in stature, because I think perhaps today we appreciate more the way in which he was living and the kinds of things that he was trying to do. I was also thinking that towards the end of his life, he started decorating chapels, you know, almost like wanting a more substantial reflection of his work. So the chapel in Villefranche, there's also one in London, right off Leicester Square. Anyone can go into Notre Dame de France and see some of his work. But I think we are more open to people who are able to do lots of things and who kind of have perhaps a giddier life.
My thanks to Francesca Simon, who chose the great life of Jean Cocteau, and our expert witness, Dr. Andy Martin. Goodbye. Thank you for downloading this programme from Radio 4. There are some 250 other editions of Great Lives available on the Radio 4 website.